you know, Charleston is just such a great place to live. I live in a house that was built prior to the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of history makes you feel like, you're just passing through, bud.
Yeah. That's super cool.
Yeah. It is. It's great. It's great. Right.
What about duck season out there? Are you guys in the middle of it, or?
Yeah. We're in the middle of it.
Okay.
You know, it's decent. Basically, you know, my little spot is a wood duck, teal, couple mallards, couple odds and ends. There's my dog. One of my dogs just making noise, but. And then around, you know, we all swap spots if you want to get on some gaddies or some pintails or what have you. But it's not prolific. Let's just go ahead and say this, guys. But you learn to appreciate every duck.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's always interesting to me, the folks like yourself that, you know, have waterfowl businesses, and then they're on the East Coast coming from the West Coast in California. It's like you think East Coast or South Carolina, it's like there's ducks, but not enough to be like, oh, we're going to start a waterfowl business or ammunition business in your case. So it's always interesting to hear, you know, your perspective being kind of in the industry and then being in a state that's not well known for waterfowl.
Yeah, and it's not well known for a reason, right? Per your comments there, we do have a rich tradition, but it's a sporting tradition in toto, i.e.
Yeah,
I could go right over here and get into the marsh grass, and if I check the tides, we have a king tide, I think, coming in, and we'll do sight casting for reds and then shoot marsh hens, right? A lot of deer. I mean, a lot of white deer, let's just face it. Alligator, right? We can go get tags right now for a 12-foot gator sitting over there that needs to be harvested. So there's a lot. So
you're
singularly focused on ducks, you'd be a problem.
Yeah, coming from our side, it sucks. But yeah, when I went out to South Carolina, we did a deer hunt, and the lady who we were with, in basically in their backyard, and you know, white tails, like you said, and it was the opportunity for the sportsman out there is incredible. But we can get this podcast started. So I just want to welcome everybody back to Save for the Blind podcast. This is Carson Odegaard with my co-host Jeff Smith, and today's guest is Mark Riegel-Buto of Migra Ammunition, the CEO of Migra Ammunition. So Mark, welcome officially to the Save for the Blind podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's nice to be here. I can't wait till we do it in person.
Hey, we tell that to everybody. We always say open invite for anybody that wants to come out to the West Coast and go duck hunt with us. Nobody's taking us up on it, but we are, by all means, if somebody wants to come out and hunt with us, more than welcome.
No, it's coming next year for sure. It's on the list. I always drive halfway over there anyway, heading to Eureka, Oklahoma, and then Kansas and everything. And so I'm already almost over there. So next year I'm just gonna keep the truck going and.
Yeah.
Pointed west.
Keep coming.
You've got a great history, right? And I look at the number of duck stamps purchased from Californians and people, I think you're number four, if my memory serves me right, in license purchases. So you got a lot of ducks, and I get a lot of pictures from friends taunting me, especially with a couple species that I don't get. So, you know, it's easy to taunt me.
Yeah, no, we're extremely lucky, and we're lucky, and there's a ton of public property to hunt as well. So, but yeah, anything that you want to hunt on the waterfowl spectrum, you can do it, from oceans to marshes to rivers to lakes, a little bit of everything in between. So extremely lucky with a ton of history, but most people don't think of California as a waterfowl destination. But once people,
I think that's going to change.
They're pretty amazed. Yeah,
yeah, I think that's going to change. And you know, not to go really far off topic, but I actually think it's on topic. Is what you just said, that you have great public access, right? Mm-hmm. Guys, let's face it. Without that, our sport is going to be in trouble. I just came back from Germany just a couple days ago, where I was picking up this wonderful dog and hunting. And first, it was next to impossible to get the license, right? So in Germany, you have to be 16 to hunt. What is this? What is this? Mm-hmm. Number two, it's only for the few. There's almost no public land, none. And so even though they have a rich and incredible tradition, which they do, it's for that many people. And I came home saying to myself, wow, for all of the complaints that I might have, we got it pretty good. So yeah. Good for you, California, that you got it. We've got pretty decent here in South Carolina, to tell you the truth. And I'll tell you what we also have got. We've got a program called the South Carolina Wildlife Partnership, which is really, I think, the future, right? Where they take, where private landowners give hunts to public hunters. Mm-hmm. So I didn't mean to go off on that diatribe, but you just nailed it right there. Something that's so important.
That kind of fits in. So me and Jeff, besides hosting this podcast, are responsible for what we have, the CWA hunt program. So our goal is private land for public hunters. So we have properties that CWA owns. The public can apply to hunt those. We also get donations from, exactly like that, clubs. It then goes into a lottery that people can apply and go out. So you hit the nail on the head. Our thought behind it is access, access, access for everyone. So if we can go out and purchase a private duck club that was once only 8 people could access, and we can turn it around for the public to come out and hunt, that's the dream, right? Everybody can then experience that.
And I applaud you for it. It is, without that, our traditions will die. And it is a concerted effort that needs to be made. So you're right on target. Your thought is correct. And that's what we try to support wherever we can, that public hunter, whether that be through the boat ramp tour, which we talk about later, supporting programs like yours. You know, everybody always talks about the youth, but when I look about how I got introduced and didn't come from a hunting background, it's people like you that influenced my life. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And talk about your background, Mark. I know you got hunted, or you got started into hunting a little bit later on in life, but I mean, what brought you into your role currently as the CEO of Migra? I mean, tell us your story from, you know, when you started and how you ended up here today.
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things in life. I think people need to know that life takes circuitous paths, and that you think you're going to set off on a journey, and that journey has a destination, but you kind of wind up somewhere else. I think once somebody's heart and soul needs to be open to things like that happening in their lives, as long as they apply themselves in the moment, do your very best in the moment, take advantage of and be appreciative of what you have in the moment. So, yeah, no, look, my path is kind of crazy, right? I didn't grow up hunting. My father was an FBI agent, so I grew up shooting. But I didn't grow up hunting. And it was a fellow named Dewey Acton in college, University of South Carolina, that took me on my first hunt, right? You stacked up in the dorms, you don't know nobody. And, you know, he invited me hunting. And, of course, I didn't know anything and didn't have anything. But, you know, they're like, I got you covered, man. Buy the beer. And so it was that introduction, and from that introduction became an intern at the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, which truthfully, you know, set me on a path to work for our U.S. Senator. While at the Senator, which was phenomenal, Strom Thurmond, on the Judiciary Committee. Now, are you guys even born yet? It's 1991 now. And
I was
on the Judiciary Committee working on the Omnibus Crime Bill when I met the folks at the NRA, National Rifle Association, right? So left the Senator to go to the NRA. And this was in Washington, D.C. And worked my way up to the manager of National Tours and Clinics. I think that was my title. Yeah. So the whole United States, from a kid that didn't grow up hunting to managing these programs and hanging out with Larry Wysoon and Jim Zumbo, famous elk hunters, and Phil Phillips, you know, PSA, you know, just all these guys that were just amazing and learned game specific and method specific hunting from all these people through the NRA. And then, honestly got burned out, if you want to know the truth. Just, it can be a lot of work. People think, oh, it's, the industry is cool. We'll get into it. Yeah, it is. But if you're on the road a lot,
yeah,
and you're gone, it can be hard on a marriage. It can be hard on raising a family. It can be tough. Because you're always chasing something somewhere, right? And so I got out of it and became a real estate developer. Became a contractor. I met a fella. Again, I was in a, if you can believe it, I'm in a watch store in Charleston. Old store. And I met this guy. And to make a long story short, I say to him, what's upstairs? And he tells me, well, nothing's been up there since 1940. I'm like, can you show it to me? And I was doing some contract work for Beretta at the time, and I needed an office. And to make a long story short, I was introduced to historic restoration by this fella. And little did I know that he was like the genius of it. I had no idea. I thought I was a jeweler. And he took me under his wing, a guy named Milton Dimitri. Saint of a man. He's passed now. And he taught me everything from electrical to masonry to joinery to plaster work, everything. It was truly life-changing. And got out of the industry and got into historic restoration and development. And I was blessed and did really, really well. Really, really well. Made it on the TV show This Old House, which, you know, I grew up with, right? And partnered up with another gentleman, built movie theaters all around the world. Built, if you think of it, we about built it. And then I sold that company a couple years back. I want to say 5 years back. So obviously I've been done it for a long time. It's got me gray. And I was in a blind at my duck club with a buddy of mine, Matt Meadows. And I remember distinctly, I was shooting crap shells. And they were very smoky. And a little powder getting in my eyes. I'm like, God dang, man, that's annoying. And he reaches over. He says, man, hey, try these. Shoot these. It's this kid. Affectionately, he says, kid that lives down the road named Drew started this company, Migra. And Migra had been in existence for about 2 years now. And I looked at him, and I looked at a white shell. I'm like, man, I don't know about that. Put it in, and whack, 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 whack. I'm like, holy crap, limited out. I'm like, I'm in. This shell's great. And then he said, you know, you should meet Drew. Drew's a really nice guy. It's him and one other guy in the company. Two other guys in the company, and you know, they're making a name for themselves, and you should meet him. And so I did, and liked him right off the rip, and knew that he had a great product and he had a great brand. And so we just started having lunch together and talking, hanging out at a little Greek restaurant that's closed, but we meet there every week. And eventually, Drew's like, look, man, you're kind of retired. I think I need an old man to help me out. I could use a couple dollars. Why don't we partner up? Why don't you come on? I'll be the president and founder. You be the CEO. And you've built companies before, and you know how to manage bigger teams and large groups of subcontractors and making things. And we just struck a deal. And that's how it happened. And that's what, 4+ years ago. And so now we're at, we just, you know, wrapped up. We've got 14 people in Charleston. What about 15, 16 people at the factory. And now are scaling rapidly. So it's been a fun ride. It's how it happened.
So at the start, did it basically start in a garage and just hand loading every load?
Yeah, so Drew, you know, it's funny how time can prove you right or right prove you wrong. In this case, prove Drew right. So Drew, an avid duck hunter, was a bit dismayed at the cost of some of the exotic metal shells that were on the market at the time, right? I mean, I think he was working for a logistics plant selling forklifts, right? Just making a living, you know, $500 for a case of shells, a lot of money. And he said, you know, we got to make steel. I wish steel could be more lethal, more effective. And there's got to be some ways to do it. There's just got to be. So we do a lot of research and, like anybody, reached around and got some very smart people and then took bits and pieces and elements and then teamed up with this dude who had immigrated from Rhodesia, if my memory serves me right. And they worked together and Drew started loading these rounds and perfecting of it. And at first they had this ugliest green line box you've ever seen in your life. I wish I had a picture of it. It was horrendous. But the shell worked really, really well, and he started to perfect it, and he started to run over to Eureka, Oklahoma, to some of our friends' place, to become one of my good friends at Tornado Valley, and test these things out and hand them out and sell them. And all the local duck hunters here in Charleston just ate them up, loved them. So it was, you know, from that little garage then to a little warehouse, and then just a natural progression up. So the answer is, yeah, that's pretty much how it started.
That's crazy. It's always amazing to me, a company like Migra or any that get into a space that almost seems impenetrable, you know, like say the high-end clothing for waterfowl or hunting in general, and ammunition. Like, you see the staples that have been around so long, and then somebody comes in and kind of shakes up the market, and then they get a foothold. It's always super cool to me. Was there a moment when you realized, like, hey, this thing's going to work, like, this is going to take off, and instead of just like, yeah, this is a cool idea, we'll see where this goes?
Yeah, I think, like anything, you know, the Migra logo and brand had gotten a toehold in Arkansas, right? And had got into some key stores, and it just needed to scale. It just couldn't quite get a handle on, was it scalable? And that's where, you know, getting a hold of our manufacturing has been so critical in the supply chain and everything goes. We can talk about that. But yeah, I think early on it was clear that Migra had something going, not only in the differentiation of the shell, but in the community that it was creating with the help of wonderful people like Wade Shoemaker and, you know, David Yanello and many, many of the ambassadors and the people that kind of embraced Migra early on. Does that answer the question, kind of?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, getting a foothold in those key companies, because, you know, I have zero clue, but I wonder how many ammunition companies or companies in general that are trying to break into the outdoor space just completely fail and nobody ever hears of them. And then, like I said, you get one such as yourself in Migra, or, you know, I think of like Shen kind of broke in a couple years ago. The 24/7 Hunt guys have their own brand now, and I know you guys have teamed up with them for a special load. So it's like there's companies that do it right and figure out what that foothold is and get through. But you know, there's probably a lot that don't make it. Just thinking off the top.
Oh, I know many. I know many, many, many. Look, it's about scale, right? And how do you scale? And with, hey, Chili, you've got these legacy brands, right? And they own all their machines, and they've owned them forever. And they have large established supply chains, right? So for the nitrocellulose, the powder, the steel, the casings, the primers, they've got it all done. It's established. And they, and matter of fact, those machines are bought and paid for, right? And they're sitting on a bunch of money. Makes it really, really, really hard to break in, right? Mm-hmm. Makes it very hard. And you're doing so many things at once to scale. So, for example, for us, right? So our stacked load, there was no machine at the time designed to build that product, right? The double drop. Not a blend, the true stack. And the machines that Migra had at the time were going to say, rigged. So what did that mean? That meant that they were very slow and had a high defect rate, which equaled spoilage, right? So you find yourself in the conundrum. Well, cripe, I need to produce more. Well, who can help me design this machine and engineer it? So you got to go to Italy, right? And you go to Ramba and EMG. Ramba is our main one. And Christina and her family, amazing people, amazing. It took us under their wing and said, look, we're going to help you with this. And they designed three machines specifically for our loads, right? The way the double drop works, we're not getting into the technology, but it wasn't an easy feat. So it was, you know, an 8-month design period and then another almost year to get the machine built, right? So you've got to look far into the future and bet on yourself. But then at the same time that you make that bet, you got to feed the machine. Where's the powder coming from?
Yeah.
Where is the casing coming from? What is the brass? Who's making the primer? Right? And it's getting all of these little pieces together into one place where you can make something consistently very, very well. And that is something that we've stubbed our toe. Have we made mistakes? Absolutely we have throughout this process. But I believe in my heart, I see it in my emails, when we do make a mistake, we own it. And the customer's like, you called me back? you made it right? Really? Oh, I wasn't expecting that. And so, Chili, Plots. Plots. Good girl. Good girl. You can tell German dog, right? And so, no, I'm not doing this right now. And so, yeah. She's a puppy, so it's kind of, you know. So moving on, we knew that there was this curve, right? Where we knew where we wanted to go. We knew we had to invest in the machines. We knew we had to invest in the supply chain. And that's what I focused on primarily. Like Drew's phenomenal at marketing and all the things he does. And he's good at manufacturing too, don't get me wrong. But we needed to divide and conquer, right? We needed, okay, dude, you go over there with the guys and help create the community and the sales distribution. And I'll go over here and create this. And so I'm proud to say that we now have a new facility in Tennessee with our machines run by our team. When federal was purchased by the Czechoslovakian group CSG. Anticipating that, we had made some overtures to a gentleman, Ed Springer, who had worked for that for Heavy Shot for 20 years. And Ed is not only the most kind, moral man you'll ever meet, he's brilliant. I mean, metallurgist, ballistician, everything. He's amazing. So we hired him a year ago, November 11th, to come to Tennessee and help us focus in on making the best shells in the world that possible. And he's been incredible. He just came back from France and Spain, where we have sister factories, and helping us, you know, engineer our new loads.
That's amazing. And Mark, can you speak to how difficult it is, maybe bringing ammo to California as a manufacturer? Is it?
Oh boy.
What are some of the hoops you gotta jump through? You know, dealing with other states like, let's say, Arkansas, South Carolina, etc.
Well, look, it's a hoop, right? I think there's a difference between an obstacle and a barrier. Right, I think that I look at things like this as what California's done is just another obstacle in an attempt to influence behavior. Now we talk about the politics of it all you want if you like. I'm not shy about that, but having most states don't regulate ammunition. Like California does, where if we send it to the person, they have to have a federal firearms license. And then you, the buyer, have to jump through a hoop as well. So very, very simply, with the proper planning, the logistic piece really isn't a problem. It's a headache. It's the financial piece that's the problem. And it's the additional, what, 11.5 or 11 tax. So think about what's going on. We already pay an ad valorem tax in the form of the Pittman-Robertson tax, right? So 11% of everything that I sell on the wholesale level. So I sell, we'll use Kittles. Let's say I send Kittles $50,000 in product. 11% of that, I'm writing straight to the United States government. 11%. Oh, wait a minute. Now California wants its 11. So 22, right? It's the financial piece that's becoming a bit ridiculous, and we're already putting more money into conservation than, I don't know, any other group. I've never seen the numbers of anybody doing more than sportsmen for conservation. I've never seen it. But now California's put this other hit on it, and it's just, in my opinion, it's unlike Pittman-Robertson, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't exactly know where that money goes.
Not to conservation.
Well, there you go. There you go. So if not for conservation, it's an attempt to modify your behavior. Right.
Yeah, no, hopefully it doesn't go to other states. You know, everyone thinks of whatever happens in California kind of scatters throughout the United States. So we don't wish that upon anybody, but it is a barrier.
I don't think it will,
folks. Yeah.
Yeah, I love you guys, and you know, maybe they won't sell me a hunting license when I come to visit you, but I think some of the realities of California governance are becoming quite obvious. And to me, knowing California from when I was young, California is a couple cities and a big giant farm to me.
Oh yeah.
You know, people don't know California is gorgeous, magnificent. And it's got a couple crazy places stuck in the middle of it that govern how the rest of everybody lives. It's truly like the Canadians feel. The Canadians, who I love dearly, right? in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and BC, they're like, who are these people over here telling us what to do? They have no idea who we are.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about my friends that are in California.
Yeah, we get that. Like we have people that have worked for us, you know, that have come from Missouri or wherever, and they come out here and they're like, wow, this is just like home for the most part. You know, it's mostly country, rural places, and they're just, you know, astonished
for sure. They do
finally come out here. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
But back to your guys' rise. How did you guys see like COVID really like help the trajectory of the company?
Well, Migra, COVID helped Migra because we had gotten ahead of the curve on casings and component supply. So where a lot of guys ran into problems and couldn't deliver, Migra delivered. So it gave Migra a chance that it might not, it would have gotten, but it got there a little earlier.
Okay.
Right? So Migra got on the shelf and people were like, well, oh, Billy Bob's not on the shelf. I'll give these guys a try. And then they're like, oh, wow, this is really great. I'll stick with it. So yeah. Our ability to deliver product on the shelf, key retailers in time, big boost for Migra, no question about it. No question about it. Big boost. And I think a lot of the other strategic moves we've made over the last couple of years have done a lot to do that too. I think, right, we started off right as a waterfowl brand. And we're all really big waterfowlers. I love Upland. This is one of my draughts right here. So I love Upland, quail and pheasant, what have you. And we said, look, we need to diversify. We've got to diversify. And we're going to start slowly with turkey, right? So we moved into turkey because we felt like a lot of our customers were also turkey hunters. But we also felt that there's a good crossover. And then if we made a really, really great turkey load, a lot of those people would then give us a try on the waterfowl side. And it worked quite well. We introduced our 7-9 stack, which I will tell you, I have had many, many, many people say, hands down, one of our best shells. It's the kinetic energy of the 9, the little tiny 9 pellet is over 60 pounds, or a pound at 60 yards. The 7 is an exponent of that. So you're getting an incredible amount of kinetic energy with the 7s, the pattern density, and significant kinetic energy with the 9. And it's just a lethal combo. And that started exposing the brand. And then we said, well, okay, we really got to get into Dove, the Dove market. But you got to be careful. The Dove market's a bit of a race to the bottom on money. And we could get philosophical about it if you wanted to. But I was like, look, I'm not going to get into the race to the bottom. That's not who we are. And we can't make a stack load for $9. I'm not interested in that. But what I want to do, and Drew wanted to do, was make a load that was noticeably different. Not marginally, not, yeah, I think there's a difference. It's like, holy mackerel. And so that's what we set out to do, and that's what happened with our Dove load. And so our Dove load has been the single most significant impact to not only sales, but to brand ID. So we introduced that 2 3/4 product. See, I've got it right here. Well, this is a non-visual podcast anyway, but yeah, it's got a 25-millimeter nickel brass and a 2 3/4. So, you know, it's a big chunk of it is brass. And that load, it's a 1 1/4 ounce. It hits like a hammer. And we went from about, 4 million rounds to, I don't even want to tell you the new number. It's just, let's put it this way. We did well over 30 containers when our first year was 4 containers. And so what started to happen is our brand just wasn't on the shelf for a few months a year, right? The Migra brand is out. Wait a minute, it's in February for turkey, then it's in the summer. So now people are shooting it and saying, wow, we're seeing a real, real difference with this product. And so we're really proud of that. Really proud of that.
Is that the thought? For the longest time, there was never even a stacked load for forever, and then stacked load started coming out. So the thought is the kinetic energy as well as the pattern density for range is...
Not much. It's just physics, right? Just math. You're getting that kinetic energy of the larger pellet, which you're really looking for. But it's the filling in the gaps with the smaller pellet is getting you more hits on target. And without getting too deep into it, if you look at our patent and the way we've got the larger and then the smaller, the larger on top, bottom, and a certain percentage, it actually acts as a bit of a cushion. I'm using the word loosely. And it helps to center the pattern, right, over more of a monolithic load. We actually now have two new products to aid in this. We have a new, what we call our NDP primer, which is a proprietary patent pending resin that has an infusion that makes it, you could look at it right away and the thing's dark gray. It's like something you've never seen before, but it's much less friction in the barrel. And so those call it our low friction wad. But what we found is, again, you ever pick up a wad, you look in it, and a couple of pellets are stuck in the bottom. Mm-hmm. You're never going to see that with this wad ever. Everything just flows out very smoothly, and we're getting this more, again, center specific pattern. And then we just again introduced our new negative degree primer, which we tested extensively in laboratory freezers at negative 41 degrees and just took them right out, put them in the gun, ignition every time. And that was some feedback we had had in our history by buying primers from other people. We all know the primer problems during COVID, right? Where we weren't getting the ignitions that we wanted. And sometimes in situations, especially if that shell had been out for even a season, you didn't quite get the ignition you're wanting and you get more of a squib, right? Mm-hmm. And what's really great about this new primer is it lets us use a we'll call it a cooler burning powder. So we're keeping our pressures under control while still getting our velocities.
And Mark, do you think some of these components in the future, there's been some biodegradable, wads and things like that in the casings. Do you think that's going to be more common as we, technology advances and potentially, the price comes down on that stuff?
Well, 100%. And I'm telling you right now, it exists. The technology exists.
Yeah.
At a great price. The English have been playing around with it for a while now. So Ely Hawk in London, England, no performance differential at all with a wad that if you shoot today in 6 months is gone. We're going with it. So you will start to see these products from us. We believe strongly, strongly in it. If you're a steward of the land, you gotta admit there's a point at which you're just pumping a lot of plastic out there, and you go to these clay ranges and you're like, Lord have mercy, this isn't good. And we try to clean up, but wads are a different thing. You and I know that. So I will argue the technology exists today with a shelf-stable product that does not really incrementally increase the price of the product, and you'll start to see it more and more. You'll see it in a couple of our products next year. Oh,
wow. That's great. Yeah, like you mentioned, I think as a hunter or conservationist, that's the one thing that is hard to get all the components and clean up, and we want to be stewards of the land. So that's great news. I love to hear that.
Yeah.
And in terms of
absolutely.
And since you guys are, big game is prevalent, whitetail, any interest in doing like slug shotgun rounds or anything like that?
No. I think one needs to be careful, right? When you're doing what we're doing, look, I'm going to tell you where our focus is. Our focus is on sub gauge. Yeah. So we're introducing quite a few sub gauge products next year. We're big. If anybody's watching Ramsey Russell, they're seeing Ramsey's playing around with one of our new loads. We're going to be introducing a couple 28 gauge, couple 410, and my personal pet project right now is a low pressure paper hull biodegradable wad product. And it's in a 12, 20, and 16. That if so, this gun I bought, this is a 1937 Remington Sportsman, right? So it's the Browning A5 before it was a Browning A5, right?
Yeah.
I want to go shoot this, but there's very few shells I can shoot in it without kind of worrying, right? And, dude, if you can believe it, when I undid the buttstock, 1937, 1938 licenses with federal duck stamp sign fell out of the buttstock.
Oh, awesome.
I was like, that's just so cool. So back to the shells. So we're making those three loads, the roll crimp. And, man, when you pull the trigger, it smells like perfume. Right?
I love that.
But it's designed at like under 9,000 PSI, where modern stuff's 11,500, right? Or more, yeah. CPI is more. I know. But that's my pet project. So you're going to see fun stuff like that, from Migra in the coming year.
That's awesome. And Mark, do you guys work with some of the other, I'm going to call them the smaller ammunition manufacturers. There's like Apex out there and a couple other brands that aren't your Federals, et cetera. Do you guys work, in terms of helping each other out and getting going? How does the competition kind of work out amongst yourselves?
So I'm going to answer that question, and I'm going to be very honest, but I'm curious if you already heard that the answer was yes.
On what?
That we help each other out.
No.
Okay. So the answer is yes. I'm philosophically maybe different from some other people in the company. I look at things more like the craft beer business looked at it, where they knew the Monster was the legacy brand that had the buying power. I will tell you that yes, without getting into who, we help each other sometimes. If they get in a bind with cases, or we get in a bind with steel, we'll help each other out. Maybe a little powder here and there. We'll compete on the product on the shelf, but it's only smart to help each other out. Yeah, so I believe strongly that we should help each other. And I will tell you that my cohort, same title in one of the other companies, believes the same way. So we talk with each other. We'll help each other when we can. And I'll honestly say this, though, too. One of the big companies that you might not think extended a helping hand once. And I've got to give them credit. And it was magnanimous of them. They didn't have to do it. I'll tell you the story without telling you the people. So, right, look, it's probably pretty obviously by what I've got behind me that I'm pretty conservative politically, right? And so I voted for the president just like a lot of other conservatives did. But what I didn't expect is to wake up one day and that there'd be a massive tariff on 30% of my steel still sitting over in China that I can't even buy in America, by the way. So that type of steel, which is wire cut versus cast, no one makes it in America. They only make it in China. But for me to wake up one day and 30% of my product is offshore with 100% tariff or some crazy number, ridiculous. You know, we're absolutely, I mean, give me some warning, please. I mean, do I want to bring all this manufacturing back to America? Yes. Do I build a facility in America for that reason? Yes. But I'm not ignorant that America doesn't make half of this stuff. That we sold, our parents or somebody sold ourselves for a cheap shirt a long time ago. But do we need to be forceful in bringing manufacturing back? Yes. So I kind of got stuck. And one of the big guys helped me out.
Wow.
Yep, one of the big guys helped me out. No, I'll tell you right now, it was Winchester. I don't even have a problem telling you. They're good folks. I mean, they're a big, giant American company owned by Olin, right? But I had a bit of a problem, and they said, you know what, this time, we're not going to make it a habit, but you're American company, we're going to help you out. So, you know, my hat's off to Winchester for doing that, and who knows what the future holds. Who knows? Maybe they'll come knocking on my door and want to buy us one day. You never know.
Yeah. But, Mark, some of these relationships that you're working with, if it's Winchester or some of these other manufacturing brands, are these relationships that you had prior to becoming the CEO, or is this all kind of new to the industry?
No, the relationships with Beretta and Benelli sprung from past relationships, but all these are new, and all these were done, whether that be with Camo Brands or whoever, by just reaching out, and I think I would like to think that it's because, you know, we've got a good brand, and that people have faith and trust in what I or my business partners say. And this industry is very, very, very small, right? Very small. And now I've been in and out of it, so I'm 58. I've been in and out of it since I was in my early 20s, right? Some of the players are still here, right? I literally was sitting at Johnny Morris's table at the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, talking with Johnny. Richard Childress is right next door. And, you know, some of the guys that were playing in the business when I was young are now, you know, in their 80s, but they're still here. And they're here because they're good, moral people who have a strong passion for the outdoors and now just want to give back, right? Now they just want to give back. So absolutely important that you have integrity and you do what you say you're going to do, even though it might pinch you and even though it might cost you. I will say time in the game in this business is important. It will come back. It'll come back in life, let's face it, but especially in this business because it's that big. And that's another reason why I'm friends with everybody. Who knows? Think about it. The head of Federal Heavy Shots production a year and a half ago was working for Federal Heavy Shots. They work for me today, right? There's a couple more over there I'd like to pick off soon enough. We'll see.
Yeah, we've always talked about how small, even just in California, like the California hunting community is. Everybody knows somebody that knows somebody that knows everybody. Like, you can't get away with stuff without somebody figuring it out. So it goes.
No secrets. No, no, yeah. Exactly. There's just no secrets. You know, look, it's just easier to just come out and say it. And if it's no, it's no. There's that great book, The Power of No, right? No is an incredible word in business. It's an incredible word in managing your personal life. No is not a negative word. No creates the boundary where you are dictating what's important to you and what you're capable of doing, and letting the other party know the same. I think if we look at some of the mistakes that we all make as people and as business, we don't say no. You know, Benjamin Franklin saying no good deed goes unpunished, right? Well, the other part of that is you could have said no. You didn't need to do it. Now, I don't mean not being charitable. You know I'm not meaning this. But I think in business, a lot of people get themselves in trouble by overcommitting, making promises they can't live up to, and then kind of hide from them. And when I took this role, I made that commitment. We were never, ever going to do that. We're going to own our mistake from the beginning. We're going to build a community based on trust. And if we can't do it, we're just going to say, move on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great way to go about it. I've got one final question. I don't know if Jeff has anything else, but do you see like the future of waterfowling going to those different alloys, or are they becoming so expensive that we're going back to steel? I with the tariffs and stuff, I know, you know, bismuth and tungsten, everything's price is going up, and those shells were already expensive to begin with. So is there just, we're just going to keep trying to build alloys, or where's that going?
Well, let's break it down. So bismuth and tungsten have gotten so prohibitively expensive, you're not going to see them. You're not going to see new product with those materials that were recently purchased. You're going to see some carryover product from last year and before. They'll stay in the market for a little bit, but at $130 a kilo, $126 a kilo, plus your tariff at, you know, 20-some percent on tungsten, no way. It's not going to happen. I used to buy bismuth for, you know what, 16, 18 bucks a pound finished shot. I think the metal market was 40 a pound ingot. Wow. So with that said, you're going to see some carryover product, and you're going to see a lot of folks, you've seen what Boss has done. I'm not going to get into what we're doing, but start moving and looking to other materials, other alloys, we'll call it, using your word. However, back to where I think Migra is going to stay true to its core, is making steel as lethal as you really need it to be, right? And I know that's kind of a strange saying. I don't need to pound ducks at 80 yards. I'm sorry, that's not for me. I want them decoying, or if they're passing, I want them within 35 or 40. I can make a steel load that'll knock them stone dead every single time. I mean, yeah. I did it this weekend. You do it. You know this.
Yeah, no, I've been shooting Migra for the last couple hunts, and I was hunting with Jeff last week and probably made one of the best shots I've ever made on two pintail, our final two birds. He got up and missed, and they were going away at 40 yards, and I killed both of them and kind of looked at Jeff and was like, wow, that was probably one of the top three shots I've ever made. And then I did it again yesterday on a single pintail going away at about 40, which, you know, maybe I was just shooting better, but I was shooting better on that one.
That's what guys like me want to hear, because now you know it's your shooting ability, let's face it. But you're confident in the shell. You're confident in you and the shell.
Yeah.
You're confident in both. And so, look, we know our conversion rate. If you shoot our product, about on average, who's going to stick with us? And then kind of come in and out. And it's a very, very, very high conversion rate. We own the youth demographic. I don't think there's anybody wanting to even challenge that one. I know what my sales are in these stores. I see who's selling what, and much cheaper than us. And I'm still selling 2-to-1 against them, and they're 50, 60 bucks a case less, right? But if you look at it, the steel product as a total expenditure is minimal. Minimal. I mean, you got more in your diesel fill-up than you do in your two boxes that you're relying on to drop that bird stone dead.
Mm-hmm.
So back to your question. I see some new materials being used, but they have some challenges. We won't digress too far, but I think it's important. So if you read the Fish and Wildlife regs, anything over 44% copper is not legal to use for waterfowl. All right? And then you scratch your head and you say, okay, what would make it legal? And then you dive deeper and you find out that there is a coating that Fish and Wildlife has approved to coat solid copper. But federal owns that. They're not loaning it to anybody. Not mentioning names, but they ain't loaning that to nobody, I don't think. So you're going to see companies, and I applaud Boss. I'm sitting here with the cheerleading pom-poms on for Boss. I want Brandon and Dirk and those guys to come out of the gate smoking, build great products, which they always have, right? And be very successful in rebuilding that company, because I couldn't imagine what it would be like to wake up having built an incredible brand around bismuth products that were very good and very effective, just to say, oh, well, guess what? No more bismuth. What? I mean, that is not, I want to compete against Boss through customers and product comparisons. I don't want to compete like that. And yeah. So I'm sitting here excited for them, excited to see what products they come out with, excited to see the products that my team are working on, and others, I'm sure. But I still think you're a year out. Obviously, Boss has got their product. Probably going to go buy some of their 28 gauge to shoot. Just, you know, I might hand load some, but whatever. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, the days of tungsten, unless something changes, are
that's over. Great insight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, think about it. So, right, the Chinese new law, if you're people that are interested, so TSS is 18 or above density. So lead, 11.3, right? Tungsten starts around 12, we'll call it, and goes all the way up to 18. I'm going to ignore bismuth and stuff for now. So the Chinese have just locked it down, and nothing out of over 17.5 can get out of the country. So anything that's TSS, done. It's over. It's not even getting out of China. So now you've got the 17.5s. But think about it. It's wildly lethal because lead's down here at 11.3.
Yeah.
But it's almost $100 a pound with the tariff in it. And so if there's 16 ounces in a pound and it's close to $100 and it's an ounce load, well, you got $10 plus just in the fill itself. Forget loading it, the powder and everything. So it's just untenable. It's just untenable. And it's when markets have pressures on them like that that the engineers start to get really creative. And things that otherwise they wouldn't have spent time, effort, energy, or expense on R&D are now being done. Kind of went on there a little bit, but to me it's interesting.
That's great insight. I literally, as you just talked about, you know, that TSS not coming out, I was thinking I should probably pick up some of the turkey shells I shoot
before
they go off the shelf.
Yeah. Yes, you should. But I'll give you what our answer was to that is take a high density tungsten, the 17, and we now have a nickel plated 5 lead on top of a number 9 17 density tungsten. And we're calling it our new hybrid load. So we're getting great kinetic energy that lead gives you, which our grandparents and our parents, right? My dad didn't, but others have been killing turkey in red plaid for years with, right? So now all of a sudden you got to have tungsten. Now lead works just fine, people.
Well, that's the problem in California. We can't shoot it.
That's exactly right. You can't shoot.
Yeah. Otherwise, I'd be shooting lead and buying cheaper shells. But
for you, yeah, you got to go buy it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Just out of curiosity, have you ever tried any steel on turkey?
I've shot just waterfowl loads back in the day when I didn't have turkey loads. And, you know, as with everything, you hit them in the right spot and you get a good shot, yes. But I'm a firm believer that if I can, you know, provide a more ethical shot on a bird or an animal, I'm going to pay the extra few dollars to make that happen if I need to.
Sure.
So, yes, I've killed turkeys with waterfowl loads and it's been fine. But, you know, I'd rather have a little more knockdown power if possible.
I'm in on a bird like that. I'm in total agreeance.
Well, Mark, we just want to say thanks so much for coming on today. Migra is our newest corporate sponsor or partner at California Waterfowl. So definitely want to say thank you for the support there. And it was a pleasure getting to know you, and it was fun talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you. I don't know if anybody wants to hear what I got to say, but yeah, it's all good. We appreciate what you guys do. You know, as a very young company, it's hard to do all the things you want to do. So you've got to be, you know, selective. But as we looked at all of the groups out there and what they're doing to promote conservation, but not only conservation, but what we really love about you guys, I love about you guys, is unabashed hunter conservationists. Unabashed. Because in the end, it's the hunter that's paying the bill. And you don't shy away. And there are, I'm not going to get into it, but some people, companies and groups, they want to focus on the conservation message, but they hide from their hunting roots. And that is something that I just can't abide. And so we're very proud to affiliate with you, support you, your mission to, you know, pass our traditions down to the next generation. Because I can tell you, my youngest is 12. I got four. I can't imagine him not doing what he does with me all the time now. And he adores it. He loves it. So thank you guys for what you do. We're proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll appreciate it. If you're ever out here, please look us up. We'll get you out.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, next year's for sure. It's not even a question. We'll be talking.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.